I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Recent crime rates in Kansas City are disconcerting, to say the least. For 3 years now, murders have gone up and up. This year, the metro could see 200 homicides. Today, hear about a new reporting series that looks beyond the statistics at the arguments that lead to murders and at the causes underlying them. Then, folks are already counting down the days to August 21st, when a total solar eclipse will span the entire continental U.S. We'll find how witnesses of another total eclipse back in 1878 reacted to what they saw in the sky. We'll wrap today with State House Blend, Missouri. Join us on Up to Date after this hour's news. At this point, it's a well-known fact that violent crime is a problem in Kansas City. In fact, we're on pace to rival, if not surpass, last year's 200 homicides in the metro, which surpassed the homicide total for the year before that, and again for the year before that. In an effort to better understand this troubling trend, a new series of reports from KCUR's Peggy Lowe and Andrea Tudhope explore the chain of events that led to particular Kansas City homicide cases from last year. The reports also dive into the factors that ultimately caused the homicides. Peggy and Andrea are here to introduce their project. It's called The Argument, and the first installment was released today. We're going to hear it, a part of it again in a few minutes. Peggy Lowe, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Andrea Tudhope, so good to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
We're also joined by Kansas City's 5th District Councilwoman, Alicia Kennedy. She's played a very active role in trying to understand what can be done to help stem the violent crime wave and has had her own encounter with it. Councilwoman, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Good morning.
Councilwoman, you're a member of the Mayor's Citizens Task Force on Violence. The existence of the task force itself points to the fact that crime is not a new problem here. For a while, it seemed like progress in reducing violence was being made, but that slowed now in recent years and even maybe reversed. How long has violent crime been a problem in this town?
Well, it's since the beginning of this town.
Yeah. It's part of us right from the start, eh? Would you say crime is finally receiving the attention it warrants, you know, from police, politicians, community groups, the media?
Yes, and the key is going to be making sure we focus on the relative parts of it and approaching it from a way that's actionable and not just discussing the problem repetitively.
You know, Peggy, as I mentioned earlier, this series is called The Argument, and I'm wondering why.
That's because in studying this issue, we were looking at the Kansas City Police Department's what's called the Blue Sheet. And basically, it's a daily report that comes out that just talks about the crime. And it basically, it's the statistics in the city. And I noticed for last year, it said that the number one motive for murders was an argument. And at first I saw that and I thought, well, duh. You know, of course, there was some sort of conflict that led to gun violence. But in talking about it, we thought, well, let's take a look at that. You know, why is it something that simplistic? Why is it always some conflict that is resolved in an inappropriate manner? So that's the reason behind the title.
It's a provocative title in its own weird way, even though it's sort of a routine idea in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, and so the first case we picked for our piece that we ran today was a pretty common garden variety argument. It was two young men who disagreed over how one of the young men treated his ex-girlfriend, who happened to be the sister of Mr. London, the man that was killed. And so this was just sort of a longstanding feud that, you know, really brewed over time and finally led to gun violence. And a young man named Daniel Wilson is accused of killing Tyrone London. They're both young black men in their 20s.
Councilwoman, I'm wondering, is this what you've seen out there? Does your experience support this idea that a lot of these homicides start out as an argument of one kind or another?
I mean, at some point, there is an altercation. It may not necessarily be an argument per se, but there definitely some type of dispute. or some approach where there was a negative interaction and their response was immediately to act in a rage of some sort that resulted in violence.
Now, Andrea, this project came out in part because of a grant that you won that was offered by the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. This is the first year this fellowship has been offered. What's the point of the fellowship?
Well, I think they're, you know, they started this out. They're trying to bring together some reporters from across the country to really cover this issue in a more in-depth way. So I'm just one of eight that got it, and the funding allows me to really dive into this issue in the Kansas City area, to really take a closer look at some of the deeper causal factors behind homicides, which is what we plan to get into with our series.
And as you've done this, what surprised you the most? What did you learn here that maybe you weren't expecting?
Well, you know, trauma, I think, has been a really interesting thing to learn about. At first, when we were kind of drawing out how we would do this, we were organizing causal factors like substance abuse, mental illness, domestic violence, and underlying all of these issues in almost all of the cases we've looked at is trauma, a history of trauma. And it's something that I think doesn't get talked about a lot, that I think deserves a lot more coverage and a lot more.
The point being that once someone has experienced trauma, that can lead to problems later on in his or her life that can lead to violence.
Right, exactly. It just carries on.
So this project fits into the mission of the fellowship then how, Andrea? Explain that to us.
Yeah, so this is, I think the one of the goals of the or what was the question?
How this project fits into the mission of this fellowship program?
Okay, right. So this is allowing journalists to really dive into the issue, and also placing it in a national context. I think this is happening all over the country, and this is kind of, you know, this center is really, really taking hold of that and embracing it.
Peggy, you've said you want this project to go beyond a typical media coverage of cases like these. What do you mean?
Well, a lot of times you see the media coverage on the idea of a high homicide rate, especially in a certain area of all towns, as sort of Murder Incorporated, you know, Homicide USA. And we didn't want to do anything like that. We wanted this to be in the light of day. We wanted this to be shown as happening in all neighborhoods. We wanted this to be shown as a problem community-wide. And so we went out, and you hear in our story, for instance, today, birds chirping. We were on a very nice block of Raytown, you know, very hardworking, people going to school, people going to work. And that's when the murder happened. It was at 8:30 in the morning because of this long-standing argument.
Well, let's listen to some birds chirping here. This is the first installment of KCUR's The Argument, where reporters Peggy Lowe and Andrea Tudhope take us right to the scene of a crime.
So Andrea and I are here in a residential part of Raytown. It's the 4600 block of Willow Avenue. Folks all along this double line of look-alike beige duplexes are getting ready for school and for work.
It was a year ago, May 20th, that the killing of Tyrone London marred a quiet Friday morning just like this one.
Police say a man named Daniel Wilson pulled up in a dirty white Monte Carlo right here, 4622 Willow. He was there to pick up his ex-girlfriend and their baby for an appointment.
Witnesses later told police that Wilson and London, both in their mid-20s, had been in a long-standing feud. Everyone was worried it would lead to something, which it did.
There were words. Wilson went upstairs for a few minutes.
Finally, he came down the stairs, and witnesses told police that he said, "I'll take your life right now," and that he shot London several times.
The numbers are staggering. That's why I call it slow-motion mass murder.
That's Mayor Sly James. The Kansas City metro area logged more than 200 homicides in 2016, placing it near the top of the FBI's list of similar-sized cities with these high murder rates. And the number one motive, number one for those shootings, police say, it's an argument.
That's the simple answer. But experts say homicide motives go much deeper. Rosalind Temple should know. She's head of Kansas City's Mothers in Charge, a group working to reduce gun violence.
It's a lot of trauma that no one wants to address. A lot of tragic stuff happened as true. It's root, ground root, deep root issues.
Tyrone London's family didn't want to talk to us until after the trial, which is set for next year. But Nita Johnson did sit down with us. She's the mother of Daniel Wilson, the young man who has pled not guilty to first-degree murder.
It was indeed an argument. It was a situation where it got out of hand.
In Wilson's case, his mom says this long-standing argument with London was about London's sister, who's Wilson's ex-girlfriend.
Nita Johnson says that back in 2014, London broke Wilson's jaw, and her son decided he needed to protect himself, so he bought a gun.
My son was like, I'm not going to take this anymore. If he tries to come against me again, you know, I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to let him do me like this anymore.
What we often see is it's a string of events. It's an act of retaliation, and then there's also I believe, a little bit of machismo that's sort of wrapped around this.
Jackson County District Attorney Jean Peters-Baker isn't commenting on the Wilson case. She's describing what often happens in murder cases.
It's normal in parts of Kansas City where you pick up a gun to resolve a dispute, big or small, right?
Right. That's what we've learned in the months we've been out reporting on Kansas City's high homicide rate. We've talked to dozens of people, prosecutors, anti-violence advocates, public health officials.
They tell us that many people simply don't know how to deal with conflict. And often the thinking is, we can take care of this problem ourselves. Nita Johnson says that's what her son was thinking.
That comes from a lack. It comes from lack of having things. Lack of being able to support yourself, lack of standing up for yourself, lack of self-esteem. It comes from just seeing that they saying I can't do it, but I can do it.
Back here on Willow Avenue, we're on a street that looks much like any other, a place where conflict can brew over time and explode at any moment, ending in gunfire. It happens in Kansas City all the time, and it's expected to get worse this summer.
Shootings like the one that killed Tyrone London inside this house are often called senseless, but they're not. To those involved, these arguments are deeply meaningful and too often deadly.
For KCUR 89.3, I'm Peggy Lowe.
And I'm Andrea Tudhope.
That's the first piece in a new ongoing series here at KCUR called The Argument, from Peggy Lowe and Andrea Tudhope. Andrea, you know, this is an extensive project. Give us a timeline here. How many reports are included? How long is this project going to be going on?
So we hope to finish the series this year. I think that's the plan. We have 7 stories total, 6 more to come. And each one will really take a deep dive into a single case, just like this one did, but even to a greater extent.
Right. And we also want the conversation to continue on Facebook. So we will have updates all the time. For instance, Sam Zeff went to a presser yesterday with the DA about the 40-something murder number in town. So we're going to have a lot of information out there, too. For instance, Jeff Sessions announcing what you were talking about at the top of the hour, Steve. So that's where we hope that this conversation for Kansas City will happen.
You know, Councilwoman Kennedy, something stuck out to me from the report that we just heard, and that was this idea that these murders, this violence is not senseless. Does that strike you as accurate?
Well, it's all senseless when someone takes another person's life. Mm-hmm. But at the moment when these young men that are in the moment, there's a sense of rage that comes over them where they feel like their pride, their ego, their respect is being challenged, and they feel like they need to protect that at that moment. And unfortunately, they make a series of bad choices that gets them in a worse predicament.
We've been hearing about this problem for a long time. How do you address it? Can you address it?
Well, I think it's important that we address the real problem. See, so oftentimes we talk about the symptoms and the effects, but you have to deal with the real issue. And the real issue is that we're dealing with an epidemic of violence in our community. And, you know, just simply an epidemic is a widespread occurrence in a particular community. And when you look at the Daily Blue Sheet, which talks about the homicide numbers, the number of people that are victims are African-American men. The number of the perpetrators are African-American men. And so the solution therein lies with someone that's going to focus on that demographic and speak to the issues, the code of that community.
Right. How does it make sense, Andrea, you know, for someone to be murdered over an argument? What's your takeaway here?
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But when you start to look at it, like we have been doing with the people that we've been interviewing, what you just said really stood out to me, because it's not just about the symptoms, right? It's about looking at this as an epidemic and finding out what led to these people dealing with these conflicts in this particular way. Mm-hmm. We're looking at conflict and behavior to try to figure out what's going on.
You know, Peggy, there's a lot of audio in your stories gathered out in the field. Why was that so important for what you're trying to do here?
Because we really wanted this to be about what's happening out on the streets. You know, Andrea and I have been working on this for months, me since last year, and we've talked to everybody, whether that's police, prosecutors, anti-violence advocates, folks like the councilwoman here, and even just those folks that go out for, say, the public health department that are canvassing in the streets and trying to combat this violence. So we really wanted to go out and learn what was happening. We didn't want to be those white public radio people who go out and say, hey, community, here's what's happening to you. We wanted the community to talk to us, and we wanted to reflect that.
That's interesting. You know, in your reporting, you guys found out there are lots of groups out there that are concerning themselves with curbing violent crime, but still progress is hard to come by. Any sense of why that is, Andrea?
Well, the people we've been talking to have been working on this issue for a very long time. It's something that's it's not new, and I think that's really important to recognize. But there's a, you know, when we see that the numbers are up, there's more of a reason to talk about it, you know, and I think that's what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. But these people have been out in the community for years. Aim for Peace, we canvassed with them one day, and, you know, these people have been doing it for a long time.
Explain what Aim for Peace is. They try to curb violence before it happens, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So they send out neighborhood advocates who, once a homicide has happened, they send out advocates to pass out flyers just to let the community know that they're here for them.
And Steve, if I might, here's a thing that we've learned about Kansas City, and this was certainly reflected in the Citizens Task Force that the councilwoman here was part of. There's a lot of really good, well-meaning folks in Kansas City out there working on this problem. Problem is, they don't really talk to each other, and they don't really like each other, and they don't really work together. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's race and class and culture and models of different organizations. But there are a lot of people out there working on this problem.
But I thought the whole trend of late with KC Nova was, in fact, people working together, groups cooperating more so than ever. Are you seeing that, Councilwoman?
I think in part. You know, what you see at the neighborhood level is kind of what we see at the macro level as well. You mentioned Aim for Peace. You mentioned Nova. However, they don't cooperatively work together. And so it happens at all levels of society where there is really a true opportunity for them to work together in an integrated manner. When you look at the one of the recommendations of the Violence Task Force is to have the CDC do an epidemiology study on gun violence in our community. And that's really the public health cure violence approach, which Aim for Peace is modeled after. Some great components of that. One is to interrupt the transmission by detecting and finding the first cases. Well, NOVA does that with the data that they put together. But the next couple of steps in that, which is to prevent the spread through interrupters, is what the Aim for Peace does effectively. However, they do not work together in a concerted manner to be able to have the outcome of the normalizing the social piece of it, which would be the outreach and community organizers piece
of it. And
that
frustrates you?
Well, I think it definitely identifies an opportunity for us to figure out how to coexist in this space so that we can have the requisite outcomes. Each has its wins and its successes, but I think there's a way for us to enhance the outcomes by forming a more effective collaborative. I think what you'll see with this federal resources that we'll get will yield some of that because the U.S. Conference of Mayors has adopted the cure violence approach. We've seen great outcomes across the country when you incorporate it in its totality. So I think you'll definitely begin to see things shift in another direction.
You know, Councilwoman, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the close encounter you had in April with this string of gun violence in our community. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I stopped at the corner store. I happened to live in the 64130 zip code, which often has a high occurrence of gun violence. However, you know, I live near Swell Parkway in a very peaceful area, a lot of businesses near Swell Park, great amenities there. But on this particular day, there was a random act of violence that occurred, and I was in the parking lot getting ready to go inside the store, and a car chase where one car was shooting into the other drove through the parking lot, and the gunfire, you know, passed around my vehicle, literally drove past my vehicle.
Now, were you inside your car?
I was inside the car. And the only reason that I had not gotten out of the car yet, because I got this little dog, and I was like, well, let me get this. So my dog really kind of prevented me from being in the crossfire. But I saw the people outside the store drop to the ground. And it's not uncommon to hear gunshots. No, you don't really know how far away they are. But yes, so that happened, random act of violence. And when I talked to the family of the person that was being shot at, his father is a city employee, very active in the community, and his son has no idea what this was about. And so these things happen. And so how do we shift that? You know, because now this young man that was being chased by someone shooting into his vehicle, how is he going to respond to that? What is going to be the interruption in him not perpetuating the cycle of violence? Because if someone's shooting at me randomly, you know, not only are you going to have the post-traumatic stress from it, but you're going to be on defense. And so is he now carrying the gun? You know, his child that was grazed by a bullet, what impact does that have on him going forward? And what do we do as a community to circumvent those occurrences?
When something like that happens to a sitting member of the city council, what kind of impact did that have on you?
It's just reality. For not only for my constituents, for
many people.
That's a shake
you up, though, too, doesn't it?
It shakes you up, but it inspired me to keep going further in this work. My mom was like, okay, it's time for you to go. You're really committed to the community, but I don't want you to commit your life to the community. but what does that say to the many seniors that can't leave? Mm-hmm. That's what inspired me to go from the prosecutor's office to city council, was because I met a woman who lived in her house for 50 years and was scared to sit on her front porch because guys were sitting out across the street hanging out loud music. She couldn't enjoy the home that she worked hard to pay off. Mm-hmm. We've got to take accountability and to bring balance to what happens in our community, and leaving does not solve that.
Peggy, the Facebook page for this series, The Argument, is what again?
It's literally called The Argument. And go through KCUR's Facebook page. That's the easiest way to get to it. It's linked up right there. Or just go to kcur.org and it's at the bottom of the page.
Well, this conversation will continue. I want to thank Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy. Alicia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peggy and Andrea, good luck with the project. We'll look forward to hearing more reports. Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about an eclipse from the 1800s and how it changed this country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, the smart money experts discussed the stock market effects of President Trump's tweets. They also debunked some common money myths. You can find that at kcur.org/up-to-date. On tomorrow's show, problematic gerrymandering in Kansas and Missouri. Is it a court issue or does a political solution exist? Also, the story of a small town shattered by the mismanagement of a resident Fortune 500 company. Well, much of America will come to a halt on August 21st, when much of the nation experiences the first total solar eclipse to span the entire continental U.S. in 99 years. Author David Barron has anticipated this moment more than many of us. He's an award-winning science writer who once worked for NPR, and he's also an umbrophile, which we'll allow him to explain in just a few minutes. His new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World, chronicles our country's reaction to another eclipse, this one 140 years ago. This eclipse, he writes, inspired the country like never before. David Barron is also a former science editor for the public radio program The World. He speaks in town tonight. David, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. I'm thrilled to be here.
Why did this eclipse 140 years ago inspire the country like never before?
So the eclipse of 1878 was a total solar eclipse that was visible in the western part of the country. They crossed the Wild West, the American frontier, at a time when total solar eclipses were very important to science, and when America didn't have much of a reputation in science. So this was a chance for American scientists, astronomers,
to pick up its game.
Exactly, to go out to the Wild West, conduct these studies during the total eclipse, and kind of show Europe that we were serious on the global stage in terms of conducting science.
You know, a few years later, the gold rush brought droves of people to the American West. But in 1878, a similar phenomenon happened for this eclipse. How much excitement did it stir? How many people went traversing across the country?
Well, I can't quantify it, and certainly you needed to have the means to be able to travel all the way out there. But there were not only scientists going out to see the eclipse, but there were tourists. There were eclipse tours that were advertised. And the hotels in Denver and Colorado Springs were overwhelmed. People had to sleep on cots in hallways and so forth. And we're seeing the same thing, frankly, in 2017. The hotels are pretty much all sold out in the zone where the total eclipse will be seen this August.
You know, some folks might be surprised to learn that astronomers back in those days were able to forecast this eclipse with the accuracy that they did. Explain that to us. Was that something unusual or not really?
Well, by 1878, astronomers, they knew when eclipses were coming, and they could map the very path where the moon's shadow would fall, which is only usually about 100 miles wide, quite well. Eclipse prediction actually goes back to ancient times. The Babylonians, the Mayans, the Chinese, the Greeks, they understood that eclipses come in cycles. So an eclipse today will repeat itself after 18 years, 10 and one-third days. And they figured out that cycle. Huh. But actually mapping the narrow path of the total eclipse is more difficult. And that astronomers were able to do by the 18th century. So by 1878, mind you, all these calculations were done by hand. There weren't electronic computers, but they knew how to figure it out.
This eclipse happened on a July afternoon in 1878. Just how dramatic did it turn out to be?
Oh, well, all total eclipses, if the sky is clear, are dramatic. I've seen five total solar eclipses. They are the most awe-inspiring sight in all of nature.
But they're so brief. Why are they so awe-inspiring?
Well, so imagine, and you don't even have to imagine because you'll get to experience it soon. The middle of the day, it goes dark. And so not like midnight, but like a sudden weird twilight.
Yeah.
But it's a lot more than that. I mean, before I saw my first total eclipse, I figured, okay, so what's the big deal? The sun goes away. But the paradox is that it's only when the moon blocks the face of the sun that you actually can see the sun, because that's the only time that it is safe to look at the sun with the naked eye. And when the surface of the sun is covered, you see what's around the sun, which is, it's the solar corona, and the word is for crown, and that's what it looks like. It looks like this heavenly crown that's sort of woven with threads of silk. And it just shimmers out in space, and you can see the sun and the planets together. You are literally looking at the middle of the solar system. And it's like space travel. You're on another planet looking at a sky you've never seen. And it is, for many people, and it was for me, a life-changing experience.
I was going to say, for a lot of people, this is a moment, this is a meditative moment of some profound sense for them.
Right. And so, I mean, getting back to 1878 and the eclipse that I describe in my book, American Eclipse, back then it was also, of course, a very moving experience. Religiously, spiritually. You have these scientists that I write about who, their excuse for going to the West was to conduct science, but they would secretly admit to each other they just wanted to see the eclipse because they were hooked. They had seen previous ones in other parts of the world, and they just wanted to experience it again.
Would you go so far as to say this changed your life somehow?
Absolutely. No, I mean, I saw my first total eclipse in 1998, and I'm a science guy. I've been a science writer all my adult life. I think of myself as very logical. I'm not traditionally religious. But it is a spiritual experience. It just connects you with the universe. You just have a sense of the enormity of space and just the beauty of creation. Hmm. And it is so brief. So it's like you've suddenly stepped through the back of the wardrobe into this whole fantasy world, and it lasts for 2.5 minutes, and then suddenly you're thrust back into reality, and you want to go visit that fantasy land again. And so that's why every couple of years I will go off to some far, far corner of the earth to have that experience again. And I am so thrilled. I have been looking forward to the eclipse of August 21st, 2017, for 19 years since I saw my first total eclipse.
You know, what's interesting about your book is that the way so many different people reacted to that eclipse, people saw different things. They were at different vantage points, some high up in a mountain, others down low. And you have all kinds of reactions from the colors of the earth to how people felt inside. It was fascinating.
Right. And so, as we've discussed, scientists knew the eclipse was coming, and the general public, for the most part, knew the eclipse was coming, and they were excited about it, and they weren't frightened by it. They saw it as a beautiful natural spectacle. But there was a very different reaction among those people who didn't know it was coming, and there were a lot of folks, particularly in Texas, who were taken by surprise. And imagine yourself out in your, you know, your farm field on a July afternoon, and the sun goes away, and you look up in the sky, and you see something you've never seen before, which mm-hmm. is this golden crown. Well, the folks who were religious were absolutely convinced that this was Christ returning, and they thought it was Judgment Day, and they were terrified.
I can't remember who it was, but someone was perched up on top of a mountain in Colorado where they could literally see the moon's shadow advancing over the earth. What an extraordinary sight that would be.
Absolutely. If I could have been anywhere for the eclipse of 1878, it would have been with those folks who were on top of Pike's Peak. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
14,000 feet up. And although they were battling snowstorms in July and severe altitude sickness on eclipse day, they were able to see the moon's shadow, which was this enormous shaft of darkness from outer space coming down into the atmosphere, and they could see it in the distance rushing in toward them at more than 1,500 miles an hour, like this silent storm that rushed over them. And in fact, because of what I learned in writing my book, that's the experience I want to have mm-hmm. on August 21st. So I will be on top of a mountain in Wyoming. I live in Colorado, and I'll be up in the Tetons, and I have plans to be up at 10,000 feet looking toward Idaho, hoping to catch the moon's shadow as it rushes in.
I bet you won't be by yourself either.
Oh, there will be. I mean, on that mountaintop, I'm sure there will be hundreds of people. In Jackson, Wyoming, there will be many thousands. And actually, I've got 13 family members joining me on that mountaintop.
No kidding. Yeah. Well, there's a word for all this that accurately describes who you are. It's umbrophile, meaning
lover of the shadow. I mean, that's a fancy word for eclipse chaser.
Yeah. What do we know about the impact that an eclipse, David, can have on people and on animals? What do we know there?
Well, in terms of, I'll start with animals. So animals think it's a weird sudden dusk, and they act as they would at the very end of the day. So birds, you'll see this here on August 21st, in those final minutes before the total eclipse, birds will start flying around like it's dusk. You may see bats come out, fireflies, frogs will start croaking. Chickens, if there are any around here, will go home to roost. And as far as people, I mean, again,
are the animals, is there any sense of fear? Or do they have any sense of something's wacky here?
I don't think so. They're just reacting the way they would when dusk comes on, and then suddenly a few minutes later, it's dawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's got to be strange. And people
react in all sorts of ways. Until you see a total eclipse, you really don't know what you're going to do. People cry, people shout, people jump up and down.
How interesting it would be to be with someone who doesn't know it's coming, as you've mentioned here a few minutes ago. That would be a great story.
Oh, my gosh.
You wonder if there are people out there this time who may not realize that.
That may be true. And I would say let's try our best to make sure there aren't any, because I still think it would be absolutely horrifying. Because it is, even if you know what's happening, when you look up in the sky and you see something you have never seen before, it's this weird, beautiful object, it is unnerving.
David Barron's new book is titled American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. He'll speak this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. You've got some advice for people, David, who might be thinking about viewing this upcoming eclipse on the 21st of August, which is what?
Well, several things. The first thing I would say is that a total solar eclipse is a fundamentally different experience from a partial solar eclipse. Now, Kansas City's in a very interesting spot because half of the city and half of the metropolitan area is in the zone where it will be total, and half is outside. Mm-hmm. So the southwestern part of the metropolitan area will see a very deep partial eclipse. More than 99% of the sun will be covered. The northeastern region will see a total eclipse. Now, you would think a 99% partial eclipse would be 99% as good as
but
a total eclipse.
But you say that's not the case.
It is not at all. And I know it sounds perplexing, but consider that if any part of the sun's surface is still visible, the day will still be fairly bright. I mean, a 99% partial eclipse, the light will get very weird. It'll be really interesting. But you cannot look at the sun safely, even if 1% of the sun's surface is visible. So if you're in the zone outside of where it's total, you'll never get to look up at the sun with the naked eye. You'll never see the solar corona, that beautiful crown around the sun.
So you say it's worth a trip to a place just north of here where you can see a total eclipse.
Absolutely. Get yourself into the path of totality, as it's called. And I understand that, so August 21st is a Monday. I understand that schools will be in session. And honestly, I would encourage schools in the southwestern part of the area to make plans to get up to the northeastern area. Partner with schools up there. Find a school that's willing to host you for the day that's in the path of totality. You really don't want your students to miss this. A 99% partial eclipse will be very interesting. A total eclipse could be mind-blowing and life-changing.
Again, David Barron's new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. He'll be speaking at 6:30 this evening at the Kansas City Public Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Just tell me quickly about one of the scientists who headed west. He has a familiar name, Thomas Edison. We don't associate him with, you know, lunar situations. He's inventing light bulbs. Tell us about Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, to Thomas Edison. Yeah, Thomas Edison. This is what first hooked me on the eclipse of 1878. Thomas Edison, 31 years old, right after he invented the phonograph and immediately before he invented the light bulb, goes to Wyoming, to the Wild West, to see a total solar eclipse. It's a part of Edison's life that's hardly been written about, and so Edison at that stage wanted to be not just an inventor, but to get respect as a scientist. And so he went to the West to do his own astronomical research during the eclipse.
What's all in David's new book, American Eclipse. What a pleasure to have you here. You tell this story so well. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve.
You bet. The General Assembly in Missouri is back in special session again. Today, the House is set to debate new abortion regulations. In this week's State House Blend, Missouri, host Brian Ellison speaks with two Northland legislators, Democratic Representative Lauren Arthur and Republican Senator Ryan Silvey, who are concerned with efforts to reverse a St. Louis ordinance banning discrimination on the basis of a woman's reproductive health choices.
You know, that was one of the provisions that I was less excited about, to be honest, because that was the state again going in and telling local governments what they can and can't do. I'm certainly sympathetic to the crisis pregnancy center issue, but that's currently also in litigation. So I did not really feel like that should be as prominent as it was in the legislation that we passed. Also goes to why I didn't really think it was an extraordinary circumstance and why we should be back in extraordinary session to begin with.
And you've said that had you had the opportunity to vote to adjourn this session, you might well have voted for that, even if you did end up supporting the legislation that came up for a vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that primarily when you look at the history of abortion law, almost every time we pass a law that deals with abortion, it almost immediately gets sued over. And in court, it will more often than not get enjoined, which means it's put on hold and it is not in effect until it's litigated. So my guess is whatever comes out of the special session, whether it's the Senate bill that we passed or whether the House sends us something different and that's what gets passed, we'll probably get sued over. It will probably get enjoined. And it won't be resolved by January. So when January rolls around, when we would be back under normal schedule, the law will be exactly the same as it is today while they're litigating whatever it is that we spent more taxpayer money to pass. So That's why I was not a fan of the special session as a whole.
I completely agree with what Senator Silvey said. And I would argue this bill could have been discussed, this preemption bill could have been discussed during regular session. And the reason that we're back in special session is because Governor Greitens failed to show leadership on this issue, identify as it a priority that he wanted passed, and now and work with people to get it across the finish line. And now he called a special session, signed a bill, two bills, Real ID and the bill from the last special session, and then hopped on a plane to D.C. for a photo op with the president. So I'm overall frustrated that this legislation could have been discussed months ago. And if it was a priority, it should have been discussed then when we had real time to sort out these issues.
What about some of the other provisions in the legislation, Representative Arthur? It puts, for example, surprise or unannounced inspections in place, annual inspections of clinics that provide abortions. It adds protections for whistleblowers, people who might work there and report violations of the law. Those are portrayed by the supporters of this legislation as common sense, health and safety kinds of provisions. What's the problem with that?
I think there are overall attempts to make it to place obstacles in the way of a woman's ability to access these reproductive health decisions. So whether it's an abortion or whether it's access to certain facilities, I think it overall just is an additional barrier to make it more difficult for her to access that decision.
So you think there's an inauthenticity, that's a fake reason for passing these rules to call them common sense, health, and safety.
Right. And I think they recognize that because the Supreme Court rulings have said if it's an undue burden, then it won't pass constitutional muster. And that's why this has been so narrowly tailored, so that they can say they've done something. But it's so narrowly tailored that it is probably going to be legal, considered legal.
And Ryan Silvey, is that fair? I mean, are these really about just trying to make abortion clinics safer, or is this really an effort to discourage abortion clinics from being opened, or to discourage people from getting abortions?
Yeah, and that's where I probably will disagree with Representative Arthur one of the few times. But I do think that it is about having a safe environment. I mean, I think we all know you're not stopping it. I think everybody understands that. You're not stopping abortion. This is the type of law that doesn't go at the woman's decision or the woman's ability to use that. But it does make sure that when that is your choice, that the facility that you're going to be in is safe. And I don't think it's overburdensome to say there's an annual inspection to make sure that, we have annual inspections of we have more frequent inspections of all kinds of places, healthcare and otherwise. So I don't think that that's an undue burden. And I think that, if it does get litigated, that part will probably be upheld. And that's actually the part of the bill that I was more interested in than the preemption part.
And I was just going to add one area where we agree is we don't want to see unintended pregnancies. Like we don't.
Right.
We'd like to see the abortion rate in the state low. Because women don't have to resort to that. But with that being said, there are a lot of decisions being made at the federal level, and a lot of it involves access and affordability of contraceptives to prevent unintended pregnancy. And I hope that my GOP colleagues sort of take leadership on that and publicly make known the position that this is one area of reducing the number of abortions that we should all be aligned with.
You know, I want to go back to the question of whether this is really designed to stop abortions or not. After the federal court struck down some of Missouri's existing regulations, Planned Parenthood said that they now would be able to open additional abortion clinics in the state. Right now there's only one. It's in St. Louis. But they said they'd open them in Kansas City and Springfield and Columbia. Is that not what this is about? I mean, some would say that it sure appears that adding restrictions seems to be the way to keep the number of abortion clinics to a minimum, which really does limit women's access to those services, right?
Well, I mean, I suppose for some of the people crafting the legislation, maybe that is their intent. I don't know. As far as what is my intent for being supportive of it, I don't think that that's unreasonable. And now if your ability to operate a clinic means you have to come into an environment that is completely unregulated, then I'm not sure that's fair to everybody either. So I think finding some, acceptable standards of what has to happen in an abortion clinic, I think, is reasonable.
So this special session will possibly come to an end this week. You're going back on Tuesday to vote on the bill that comes over from the Senate. Representative Arthur, what do you think will happen in that debate?
I've heard that they plan on moving forward with a time debate. So each party will have 2 hours to speak on the bill. And it's certainly more fair to the minority party and an opportunity for us to pick who we'd like to be the spokespeople for certain parts of the bill. It allows us the ability to plan and organize because typically during normal floor debate, we don't know who will be called on and who will be prevented from speaking on an issue. I suspect there will be a number of amendments offered on both sides. I expect that the Democratic amendments will fail because mm-hmm. they typically do. And, there's obviously been a call to add additional regulation into this legislation. And
The governor didn't get everything he wanted in the first draft of this bill.
Right. But we don't work for the governor. And I think that's one of the more frustrating elements of these special sessions is that lawmakers will sort of privately grumble that they're being called to do something that they may agree with the legislation, but they don't agree with the fact that we're back for a special session. A few, like Ryan, have spoken more publicly.
Not so privately grumbling.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And until people really show that we are an equal branch and that we can make decisions and don't have to follow through with what the governor forces us to do in some circumstances, I think this is going to continue to happen, and this will not be the last time that you do a State House blend on a special session this summer.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking some time with us, Senator Ryan Silvey, Republican, and Representative Lauren Arthur, a Democrat, both from Kansas City North. Thank you both for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
This is the part of the show where we turn it over to our guests to choose our closing music, music that captures this moment in Missouri politics. We have two legislator guests, so they will each make a proposal, and I will choose. Let's start with Senator Ryan Silvey.
Pink Floyd, Welcome to the Machine.
Representative Lauren Arthur?
There's a song I've been listening to called When They Fight by the Generationals.
We're going to go with Pink Floyd. Representative Arthur, I apologize, but Senator Silvey is pretty good at choosing the music for this show.
That's not a bad one. So.
All right. State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp and Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
That was KCUR State House Blend Missouri podcast. To hear the full conversation, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and on the NPR One app. Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, a look at the problematic gerrymandering in Kansas and Missouri and how the mismanagement of a small town's Fortune 500 company shattered the community. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. You didn't like school.